What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I speak with Bradley Stain. Now, Bradley Stain is a very interesting person who, after witnessing the Strydom massacre during apartheid in South Africa, which is an infamous event in South Africa, joined the South African Navy. He later was recruited by Major Andy Miller to join the apartheid regime's security branch, which was the security police apparatus of the apartheid state in South Africa. Later on, Bradley was selected for NOC, non-official cover espionage, during the last years of apartheid in the build-up to the first democratic elections in South Africa. He worked underground for the liberation movement and served as a covert asset of the spy unit within the military wing of the African National Congress, or ANC. This was when Nelson Mandela was president of the ANC and would go on to become the first president of a free South Africa. The South Africa native, Stain, is a national and geopolitical security expert, news media contributor, and co-author of the best-selling book, Undercover with Mandela's Spies, The Boy Who Crossed the Square. Passionate about mental health and an activist against racism, hate crimes, and corruption, Stain is a champion for a stable, stronger South Africa. It's an incredible life and a bunch of incredible stories that intersect with world history, certainly as it relates to apartheid and South Africa. And now I give you Bradley Stain. Okay, I'm here with Bradley Stain. Bradley, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All the way in South Africa. So we're a few miles apart here. Thanks to the magic of Zoom, here we are. There's so much I want to talk with you about. Certainly, you know, South Africa, apartheid, your career, your role in it, the various roles that you played in it. But before we do, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Sure. So my name is Bradley Stain. I was born in Pretoria, South Africa, which is the capital of South Africa. And for many years, I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and involved with security services for the apartheid government. Later on, I had to flee out of South Africa. I ended up in England for a while and eventually in the United States. I've traveled to over 111 countries doing security work. I'm a security professional. I work as a geopolitical security advisor, program manager. I also have been fortunate enough to work in rock and roll and travel all over the world with recording artists, some of the greatest artists. I've been very fortunate. And also to work in film and television. And that's who I am.
So, Bradley, I'd love for you to tell me a little bit about growing up in apartheid South Africa. What's the environment like? What's the give our listeners a sense of the texture of growing up in apartheid South Africa.
Well, I was born in early 70s in a pretty normal neighborhood. If you didn't know what was going on outside a few kilometers away, where hundreds of thousands of black people were segregated into communities that were strategically placed close to railway lines, railway stations. That's the way that they designed apartheid. They went to the Nazis. They went to a lot of the history books on how to manage mass populations from a securocratic point of view. And they had the Group Areas Act, so they would put people of color away from white neighborhoods so that, you know, they wouldn't get in the way, they wouldn't cause problems for white people. And we lived in the suburbs. So I happened to live in a suburb just outside Pretoria, the capital. It was actually a place called Verwoerdberg, named after one of the presidents of South Africa. South Africa at that stage was probably one of the most powerful land force military countries in the world. We had developed at that stage 7 atomic bombs, nuclear weapons, rapid deployment, land deployment, military deployment, fixed wing ground deployment was on par with, like I've said, the best in the world. So I lived in this suburb for Woodburg that had several military bases. Waterkloof Air Force Base was close by, and SWAT Corp military base was close by. So a lot of the people and the kids I went to school with were, their parents were in the military or in weapons and defense related industries, etc. The one thing I did notice was my parents were a lot more liberal, my parents were more outspoken against racism. So, you know, when I'd go to my friend's house, for instance, for a barbecue, what we call a braai here, my parents would have to think really hard, how racist are those people that he's going to go hang out with, kind of thing. So,
wow.
But, you know, for the most part, you know, we had a great life, you know, played rugby, played cricket. We rode BMXs through the fields, chatted up girls. We had a great life. The only difference was that there were no black people or people of color around us because they were segregated. The people of color that were around us were domestics working in our kitchens and in our homes and at businesses, etc. So it was almost like a Stepford Wives kind of environment where it's controlled.
Interesting. Thank you, Bradley. I appreciate that. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your, what you've called, you told this to Jordan Harbinger, your introduction to racism. And I believe this involved your mother, if I heard that right.
Yeah. Actually, as I was just going through this, thinking about this, talking to the South, it takes me back to Sonia Street in Dorenshaw's of Woodburg, where I'd just been picked up from rugby practice. And so sitting in the back of this old Peugeot was my mom and dad, and we were driving down the road, and well, we just took a corner and we started driving down the road, and my mother saw a commotion on the left-hand side of the road. She saw this white man beating this black man. And my mother said to my father, Herman, pull the car over. Let me go help. That's the kind of lady my mom was. She was a no-nonsense kind of lady, and, you know, she was an opera singer. She was bigger lady. You know, she had a presence about her. My dad said, no, let's not get involved. And as we drove past, we saw Philemon's face. Philemon was a young man that used to come to our house and work in our garden and take care of our garden. So my mother grabbed the steering wheel that yanked to the side. My father managed to get the brakes going and stop the car. My mom jumped out of the car. My dad, St. Daphne, please. And then I remember just turning back and looking through the back window of this car and just seeing my mother pick Philemon up, walk him back to the car while this guy's screaming at my mother. My mother put him in the back seat of my car, and he has this young guy that I play soccer with, back garden, that I'll go eat lunch with them from time to time. And, you know, he's my mate. We used to play soccer, you know. And now he's bleeding, and, you know, he's just had the crap beaten out of him, and he's crying. And Dad, who's this very kind, gentle guy, turned and he said, Philemon, it's okay. You're safe now. It's okay. And I turned back and I looked around. I saw my mother waving her finger at this guy. And all of a sudden, I just saw my mother give him a big flat hand, smacked him, pecked him on the ear. And, you know, he bounced against the hood and fell on the ground. And then his wife jumped out of the car and ran to my mother. And there's a bunch of pushing and shoving, and my dad managed to coax my mom back into the car. But yeah, it was terrible. You know, I must have been, I was a young teenager when that happened, and I didn't understand. And that's when I learned what a passbook was. So during the Group Areas Act, etc., and the operational format that they'd put in place to manage this mass population, as you've got to remember, you know, I think it was a few million white people in South Africa were oppressing millions and millions and millions of black people. So it didn't make sense. But, you know, with the military and the security state that they created, one of those things was a passbook. So it's like a driver's bill, but it's more like a ID book where, you know, you couldn't be in white neighborhoods. I think it was something like before sunrise and after sunset. So at those times, you had to be in the township, the locations, the segregated areas. And what had happened was the sun was going down. This white guy thought, you know, who's this black guy walking around? And he's just very racist guy. And you get a lot of people like that, and they just have a lot of hate.
Yeah.
And they just want to hurt people. And, you know, that's how I first encountered racism as a kid in South Africa.
On the rare occasions where I've been able to speak to people about apartheid, one part of it that I always like to bring up, which seems to surprise people, is the idea of the honorary white.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like to highlight it because I think it demonstrates the real absurdity of racism, you know, that the Japanese, for instance, can be deemed as honorary whites because they have a good commercial relationship with South Africa. And I'm just curious if you could talk at all about the idea of the honorary white.
You know, during apartheid, it was this bizarre structure and system where if you were exactly in business with people, etc., or if you were a colored person or an Indian person, you know, you weren't seen as bad as a black man, like a Isikosa man from the Eastern Cape or Zulu from Zululand. These are the what you call fellow black countrymen by their tribal names, were deemed the most inferior, if I could say it that way. And then, yeah, you'd get your honorary white status, etc., where, you know, it was okay because he's either giving us intelligence or he's doing business with us, etc. So it's a very perverse way of creating a secure and chaotic society, as I like to, I guess, phrase it. You know, basically, you know, what the South African government did was they decided to weaponize racism and use it to their political agenda. You know, but we have that all over the world. We have that in the United States with police brutality and, you know, systemic racism, how that's still very prominent and how the civil rights movement in the United States is still trying to fight that and address that.
Thank you, Bradley. I appreciate it. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about, I hope I have it right, about Straight On Square.
Straight On Square. Sure. Yeah, not a problem. You know, so Straight On Square was named after one of the presidents of South Africa. He was a statesman for the National Party governments in South Africa and somebody that a lot of white conservative South Africans respected. And he had this giant, massive statue of his head in the square near the center of Pretoria, very close to Church Square, which is the main square in Pretoria. And my mother worked right next door to it in our national theater, which was called the State Theater. And that night, we were going to go and watch the opening of Giselle, the ballet. And again, I had just finished playing rugby. I was in high school. I was 17 years. And I used to catch the train into town from my high school. And, you know, it maybe took 10 or 15 minutes and I'd get into town. And my mother liked me to walk a certain way straight down to Straight On Square to the State Theater to meet them. But I liked to take this roundabout road, which was a little more colorful, where you see the real people, true South Africans. You see the smiles on people's faces. You see the energy and the life and the hustle and bustle on the streets and hawkers trying to sell their wares, their oranges, etc. You know, these very different sights and sounds of what I'd get to see back home in my Stepford Wives secured community. So I'd love to go walk down there and I'd listen to the call to prayer, you know, because that was the white area. It was on the border of the white and the black area in the capital of Pretoria. Anyway, so I was walking through that part of town and I got to Straight On Square and I was, you know, 17 years old, cocky young guy. I got my rugby kit bag. I'm going to go watch ballet, see these beautiful artists dancing on the stage and listen to this beautiful music. And as I was walking, I heard two cracks, loud noises, and I knew that they were munitions. I knew that was a firearm going off. And I saw the faces of black people running towards me, and there was just chaos. pigeons flying on the square where people were feeding them before it. People were sitting having lunch and people started scattering. And I was inquisitive to see what was going on. And I looked and I saw Striding with a pistol in his hand. A guy must have been about 6-7 years older than me, military-aged male. And he just walked up to this black person and he just shot them. I remember grocery bags falling out of her hands, landing on the ground, and her body hitting the ground. And this area that he walked in towards was almost like it had a big boundary around it, like a short bench that was made out of marble, almost like a massive planter box that you could sit on the edge of. But in the middle, it had this little pathway with little benches where people could, you know, get off their feet and have lunch or, you know, just sit in the shade for a bit and just relax. And he was walking through this walkway. I was on the outside and I found myself behind this little wall, looking over the wall. And I saw him walk up to other people and he shot these other two black people that were just sitting there innocently that hadn't run away. And all of a sudden, I heard to my side, cling bus, which means little master, in a subservient way, even in that horrible situation, he's still calling me master. And this young black man with kind eyes calls me over. He says, come hide here. You're going to get hurt over there. So he was concerned. Anyway, I was 17. I was a young kid. I wasn't quite sure. I thought, you know, he was in full camouflage fatigues. I thought that he was part of the security police. I beg your pardon, not the security police, the task force, which was a domestic counterterrorism reaction point force, the South African security services. But he wasn't. He was going up to these innocent people and just shooting my mom. So I went and I hid with kind eyes. As soon as I got there, some other guys jumped up and ran off. And then Stratum saw those through the bushes and he started shooting towards the bench where I was sitting. And kind eyes was sitting. I still remember the bullets hitting the bench and the marble shards stinging the back of my neck. And after that happened, we looked up and over the bench again, and for some other reason there was a guy eating a sandwich or a burger or I don't know, he was eating something. This guy walked up to him with the fatigues and he shot him once. It was very eerie because I could still see it. He was just sitting there in complete disbelief of, you know, well, what's actually going on here? And then he shot him again and he fell over on the bench. As soon as that happened, something clicked in Kind Eye, or something rather snapped in Kind Eye's, and jumped up and he ran in the direction of the gunman. And I was like, got to do something. I, my DNA, I guess, and my makeup of who I am as a person, you get those fight or flight people. I guess I'm that fight person that, you know, I want to try and help. So I followed him. I ran to the planter boundary wall. I ran around. As soon as I ran around it, I saw him shoot Kind Eyes, this young kid who had just given me shelter twice. And he fell down as I was going. So I continued and he caught me out of his peripheral vision now, periphery. He took his 9mm and he pointed it at me and saw I was white and then was like, oh, you know, kind of being it. It's hard for a lot of people to hear this, but, you know, my white privilege honestly saved my life that day. And, you know, I know people are conflicted and confused by the use of the word, but the thing that is there, it's real, it exists. So I went down, I picked Kind Eyes' head up and I put his head on my lap. And this young guy was terrified and he had fear in his eyes and there's just blood everywhere. And I didn't quite know what to do. Instinctively, I put my rugby jersey shorts. I can't remember. I just remember from Boy Scouts, I needed to try and stop the blood, but it was in his lungs. So it was, and eventually I just stuck my finger and it stopped and then pulsating out. And then eventually the emergency services arrived. And yeah, I also just want to say that, You know, it took me a long time to talk about the story because it was so painful and hard. But I've realized that it's helped me with my mental health through this journey, and it helps a lot of other people. I've come to learn it as well. So, you know, it's something that I have to do now, this terrible story. But it's so difficult.
Yeah. And I'm grateful to you, Bradley. It's important. It's important in history. It's important that people know about it.
Yeah.
And so then moving forward, if my research was correct, this is what primarily influenced your decision to join the Navy, correct?
Well, no, my biggest problem is that what terrifies me in the United States today, for instance, with all the active shooters and, you know, the mass shootings and massacres that happen in the United States, is that there's so much mental health fallout. But, you know, this was in that happened on the 15th of the Stratum Square massacre happened on the 15th of November, 1988, if my memory serves me, 88. Yeah. And, you know, but the point that I'm making is that I tried to go back to school. I had two more years of high school, but I was so damaged. I was mentally, things didn't work the way that they were working. I wasn't that happy-go-lucky kid that, you know, would ride around on his BMX and have fun and laugh, and, you know, we'd go try and chat up girls and stuff. I was angry. I was confused. I didn't know where our moral boundaries were anymore with regards to how we protect ourselves. Was there some sort of justifiable act in what Stratum had done in protecting us from the black danger, because there's millions and millions and millions of more black people than they are white people. The indoctrination that we had got growing up as white South Africans, that they were going to come and chase us into the sea.
Mm.
And that, on top of that, biggest problem was that, you know, the black radicals, as they were painted, which they were freedom fighters technically, had socialist ideas and communist ideas rather. So the red danger, they call it Reufafa, the red danger was going to come and take over our country. And this happened after the Berlin Wall fell. You know, the Cold War had ended in the United States. The big emphasis was now sub-Saharan Africa and African natural resources. So a lot of the international focus was now placed on sub-Saharan Africa and what was going on. There was this dirty clandestine war going on. But I was disruptive. My parents didn't know what to do with me. We didn't have the mental health resources available to us that people do today. And my parents just couldn't handle me anymore, and they ended up sending me to the Navy. I was supposed to get because South Africa at that time, you had a national service call up, very similar to Israel, where they call people up and they do 2 years of national service. My national service call was to Kalibowa Infantry, which is a remote infantry post on the north border of South Africa near Zimbabwe. But, you know, my parents changed it and said I was going to join the permanent force, and I ended up going to the South African Navy. And, you know, my journey in the South African Navy, you know, took me to Saldanha, which is Naval Military Training Base, about 2 hours away from Cape Town, or an hour and 45 minutes outside Cape Town off the West Coast. And, you know, that's where the naval recruits went to go and do their basic training. And, you know, I ended up in the Navy. Yeah. But, like I said, I was suffering tremendously from health issues. I wasn't on any medication. I wasn't speaking to any therapists. And I was quite lost at that stage in my life. And so after the Navy, I met somebody in Cape Town by the name of Cornelius de Beer, Neil de Beer, who earlier had been approached by a guy in the security police here in the Western Cape called Major Andy Miller. And he was tasked with creating a covert program that was a cover program for clandestine operations. It was a front. And the front was a security company, but Neil needs to go and recruit fine guys. And he met me, and I joined his organization. At that stage, I thought it was just a security company in Cape Town, here in Cape Town, taking care of security contracts, etc., which it did. It did the majority of the entertainment venues throughout Cape Town. But he was always taking me away from the rest of the guys, and we'd go and meet with people, have secret meetings. And eventually I was read in by Major Andy Miller, who was financing this program through the national body government at the time. And, you know, we were responsible for picking up intelligence around the entertainment venues where a lot of ex-active military people would come drinking holes, etc., where we could pick up human intelligence, and, you know, we were also tasked at the time to get close to somebody that was a very powerful individual area that we call the Cape Flats, which is one of the most dangerous places on earth. I don't know if you've heard about it or if any of your listeners have heard about it. It's a place that houses hundreds of thousands, millions actually, on the outskirts of Cape Town. A lot of drug activity, a lot of gang activity first, drug activity, extortion, crime, etc. And there was a very powerful guy out of that community called Cyril Beaker that was very active, and we had to get close to him and get to know him. And we brought him on. He had a great set of expertise. He also had a small security company that had dogs, so we amalgamated them with our company. He didn't know at the time that we were part of the security police. Coincidentally, we didn't know at the time he was part of Nelson Mandela's intelligence units with the Department of Intelligence and Security under Kontowe Sizwe, which is Spirit of the Nation.
Yes.
So, you know, that's how we were, or rather what we were tasked to do from a operational point of view. Once, you know, we did get in close enough to us, he was, funnily enough, feeding intel back to those guys on us. We were feeding intel back to our guys on them. And at the same time, our handler was also trying to figure out if we were playing both sides at the same time. It was an incredibly stressful time because, you know, what was going on with me, you know, was my mental health, and on top of, you know, living as close to the truth as possible, which you need to do in clandestine tradecraft. You know, it was living these different lives. And
yeah,
it came to the breaking point, or came to the big changing point, where somebody had a guy by the name of Stephen Kumalo. He was trained by the KGB in Russia, and the South African intelligence community picked up intel actually from the Americans that there's a KGB-sponsored asset that's been trained by the KGB that's coming back to South Africa, and they're rolling out a big operational plan. We were tasked, Neil DeBeer and myself, to go snatch and grab him, shake him around a little bit and see if we could get any actionable intel out of him. So then Stephen Kumalo started telling us about the Freedom Charter, which is very similar to the American Constitution. And within it states that the South Africa that the African National Congress has in mind for all its people is in fact that, a South Africa for everybody. He told us that he considers the white people also a tribe of South Africa now. And that, you know, they want a unified approach to governing the free people of South Africa, and that people shouldn't be segregated. I call it my coming to Jesus moment, because the penny dropped for me, because, you know, I realized at that time that the indoctrination that we had got from school, what I witnessed Strijdom do, was truly counterproductive to what is most important is putting human capital, if I could put it that way, first for the military, ex-military kind of people that might be listening, but putting humanity first. And it sent us on an adventure that was scary, that was very complicated. And my former handler and former mentor, Major General Jeremy Vieri, talks about it. He calls it the righteous betrayal. But, you know, a lot of white South African people think that myself and Neil De Beer betrayed our race. They call us friars, which means people that have betrayed Neo. But, you know, it was very important for us to try and see if we could collectively come together and disassemble this politicized racism and that was being used within the securitocratic system. And it was very challenging, you know. We had great intellectual intelligence minds at that time working on this, the likes of Andre Lincoln and Jeremy Vieri and John Nkhlala, who was, you know, the head of the ANC's intelligence at that stage. So a lot of thought had to go into, you know, how we do this. And we, in essence, got given a first prize and a silver plaque to win. Major Andy Miller, who didn't know we had now jumped sides and we were double agents at World. Exactly. He didn't realize it at that stage, although he had put certain things in place where you try and trip us up and catch us out all the time. So it was nerve-wracking because this guy was a very scary man. You know, that kind of guy that you see and the shiver runs up your spine. He was capable of the most horrible things. You know, for him to take a life, it meant nothing. Life is very cheap. They say life's very cheap in Africa, and he was probably an architect. All that, you know, so we had to be incredibly careful, you know, but this operation that he had tasked us with was through a clandestine operation, we had managed to infiltrate a stockpile of weaponry that was sponsored by the Soviet Union.
Was this smuggled in the bathtub?
Yes, that was smuggled in through Angola. And, ended up in a bathtub. Major Miller sent us to go and raid this house covertly, but just telling us to remove documents, but telling us to check every single room and check every single corner of that property. He knew we were going to find the weapons, and he knew that we would move the weapons, which we did, and which just brought more favor with him, and he trusted us more. So it was constantly this chess game of tradecraft, and it was nerve-wracking, to say the least.
Thank you. There's a couple doors open here that I just want to kind of address, just in case any of it blew past our audience a little too quickly. We covered a lot just then. So you were with the South African Navy. You were then recruited by this man, Major Andy Miller, to work in a clandestine operation, the SB, the security branch, right? Effectively the secret police. Right. And then in that capacity, you had all kinds of, I hate to make a euphemism, but, you know, misadventures. We just talked about the weapons cache in the bathtub. I want to ask you about the taxi wars and the Tape Town Tiger Mall shortly. But then following that, you then did double agent work for the ANC, which I know I'm kind of giving it the broad view, but this was what Nelson Mandela was the president of. This is the African National Congress. In that capacity, you then worked as a double agent for them back on the security branch. So you are now infiltrating the SB. Do I have that broadly correct?
Yeah, that's spot on. That's
okay.
That's a good way of unpacking it. So
it was a lot there. So I just wanted to make sure that our listeners were caught up with us.
Yeah. And, you know, they say what gets spies to flip. For the majority of the time, you know, we've seen dozens of ex-FBIs get flipped by the KGB back in the Cold War because of money incentives, etc. Money's a massive thing here, but you know what made us flip and what made us turn was us not, like America today, us not being able to bear to see black people and people of color being mistreated and seeing them live in this that bureaucratic society that was inhumane. So that's what fueled us. I just want to clarify, well, it wasn't money. It wasn't, are we scared now because the government's going to change eventually? It wasn't. It was driven by what the Freedom Charter truly and fundamentally stood for. That, you know, there's going to be a place in the sun for all of us in this great country. This country with so much potential. And, you know, that's why we decided to flip sides and start spying against the security police.
Wonderful. Thank you, Bradley. I would love to ask you about, because I think I just think it's interesting, the taxi wars and what your involvement was in it. Would you take a minute or so on that?
Sure. So during that time, Major Andy Miller was very, very close with the head of, I think it was called SABTA, South African Black Taxi Association. And what the security police was doing was inciting political violence by using the taxi association. So for your listeners that don't know, those millions and millions of black people that aren't segregated communities that live outside the capitals of outside the major cities would use trains and taxis. So when we say taxi wars, this isn't these, you know, New York taxi cabs, yellow taxi cabs. They're minibuses driven by people that have had hard lives, that have come from different walks of lives. A lot of them had criminal histories in their past, but now taxi operators. And there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them across South Africa. So they're very, very powerful. They move our workforce in this country still to this day. And what the security police and Major Andy Miller did was use them to stoke political violence. I think there was another taxi organization that in the late 80s, early 90s had an affiliation with the African National Congress, and that was PODETA, which was a opposing taxi union kind of thing. If you think Jimmy Hoffa kind of thing,
yeah.
But you think, you know, these minibuses with sometimes just passengers, but a lot of time moving military age males around to go and orchestrate politicized agendas, you know. So, you know, there is a lot of that in South Africa during that. What Major Andy Miller did was to task the taxi association to go and cause disruption in the townships around what we had deemed actionable intelligence of other operations that were going on. And we weren't involved with this particular case, but they had just assassinated in a drive-by shooting in Johannesburg, about 12 hours drive away, 2 hours flight away, the assassination of PODETA, which was the ANC's linked taxi association that used to help move a lot of ANC operational guys around throughout the country. And what they did is they retaliated, then they tried to come and hit him and kill him. We were tasked with extracting him, protecting him, and there was a massive shootout in the overpass at Golden Acre, which is a shopping center tower kind of thing right next to our train station here in South Africa, here in Cape Town, rather. And yeah, that was touch and go. That was a incredibly scary operation that went awry. We were supposed to get fully automatic rifles to take care of him. They didn't give us fully automatic rifles. And then opposing taxi association found us, and we got into a contact situation with them. And you never want to be in a gunfight with a 9mm against a fully automatic assault rifle. But, you know, we managed to survive. A ricochet missed my heart by inches. I lost my driver. My driver was shot in the And the elder bear helped us get out of that situation. And, you know, we managed to save the head of the taxi association's life as well. And, you know, it's funny, you train for these things, these scenarios, how to use cover, how to use the engine block, how to use, you know, the rim, the hubcap or the wheelbase or the thickest part of the vehicle. And then to return fire, but it's a different story when you hear fully automatic assault rifle going off and your client's panicking, he's pissing his pants, he's trying to get up and run. This is what happened. You try to get up and run, you get a pistol, light a pistol whip him, back of the head, calm him down, sit on him. Otherwise, he would have got shot. So, well, he could have got shot. But yeah, operationally, it's crazy how and it happened so quickly. It was
incredible, Bradley.
So, and yeah. these taxi wars, I know this wasn't a minute, a little longer than a minute. These taxi wars continue, you know, still to this day in South Africa. You know, unfortunately, that's a whole nother segment, but the South Africa that, you know, we fought for is not the South Africa that all our people deserve today. Our people are still incredibly impoverished and there's a lot of problems. Our beloved ANC has sorely let us down, let the people down, and we were this close to civil war.
It's incredible. Thank you, Bradley. I don't think I could forgive myself if I didn't ask you about breaking into Major Miller's office and what you found and what it meant.
You know, once we were recruited by Commander Nakhala and then handled by Jeremy Vieri and Andre Lincoln, this was at a very tense and crucial stage within the security services, intelligence services in the South African government. They started to see the writing on the wall. It was crisis management time and damage control time. So a lot of guys were panicking and a lot of guys were trying to sell off all their stuff, go to the state, go abroad. The interesting thing is that, you know, a lot of very conservative white power type of groups around the world would be sympathetic to the apartheid. Mm-hmm. And a lot of global white supremacy groups would be empathetic to the apartheid system and want to support it. And a lot of that did financially. They supported a lot of small militant groups, for instance, like all the apartheid movement, which we infiltrated. There were groups that were behind the assassination of Chris Hani. But it was a very tense time around then. And what we needed to do was to try and figure out double agents were. So who within the African National Congress was, and who within the PAC, the Pan-African Congress, which was another movement, yeah, but they were a lot more radical, who they had on their payroll, more specifically the ANC, who in senior ANC leadership was, in fact, selling Nelson Mandela, Oliver Tambo, Walter Sisulu out, selling the idea of what the ANC was trying to accomplish out. And, you know, we went into Major Miller's office. We gained access into his office. Now, you got to remember, this is, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. Xerox machines are just, you know, coming out. You know, so what we were trying to do is make as many photocopies because of actionable, what we deemed might be actionable intelligence, making photocopies, etc. And we got to a point where we didn't know where more paper was. And, you know, in a situation like that, when you're breaking into a high-ranking intelligence officer's office, you know, it's quite nerve-wracking. You know, we didn't want to put anything out of place, which might put up red flags, etc. But, you know, we were also very, very desperate because Major Miller was changing a lot at that time. He was drinking a lot more. He became a lot more irritable. And, you know, this guy didn't go anywhere without his 9mm. He'd just pull it out. So it became a very uneasy environment to be in that. So we knew that our time potentially was coming to an end. So we made a calculated decision that, you know, maybe this is worth the risk. And it was, you know, we discovered people that were operating on the other side, and we handed that intelligence over to the people that would analyze it. And the policy makers within the decision makers rather that stage because we weren't in government yet. It was still a political party, freedom fighting movement to make the right decisions. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's only so much that you can do
because, yes.
You know, we're still trying to correct some of the wrongs from the past. And a lot of that has to do with the demise of our country and where we are today. I feel a lot of that actionable intelligence has also hindered the careers of Andre Lincoln, who became a major general in the South African police, who was the head of our anti-gang unit, and Jeremy Viery, who was supposed to get one of the top cop jobs in South Africa. You know, these guys have been sabotaged by what, you know, we discovered and by what we exposed.
Yeah. Understood, Bradley. Well, and I know we're coming up on our time a little bit, Bradley. I have maybe just a couple questions left. Is that okay? Or
no.
Oh, I appreciate that. So I made a note here from our discussion a little bit earlier. Could you talk at all, Bradley, about why you had to flee South Africa?
Sure. So ultimately, what ended up happening was, like I say, it was given to us on a silver platter during this very contentious time in the intelligence community as the walls were sort of crumbling around, and there was a cell, and this is just after Harney was assassinated. It would have been Chris Harney or Nelson Mandela would be president. South Africa, but you know, they got to Chris Harney first, and they unfortunately assassinated him. And that he was our commander. He was the commander of Kotowe Sizwe. He was an upstanding man, a righteous man, no bullshit kind of guy, and you know, somebody that I don't think South Africa would be in the mess it is today if we had leaders like him around. But unfortunately, he was taken away from us in the most gruesome and vile way, in a political assassination that was sponsored and backed by white power extremists that had done a partnership with rogue elements within the National Party government. The guy that was involved in Commander Harney's assassination, Clive Dalby Lewis and Chambers Bullis and Lewis's wife, you know, these are people that didn't act by themselves. You know, they'd been given orders, and they followed orders. So, you know, the whole myth behind the fact that they orchestrated this the way that they did, and that it was just this group of them doing it, is not true. We later on found actionable intelligence that this group WAMP, World Apartheid Movement, who has had sponsors in the United States, right? James fanatic skinhead groups, right wing or white supremacy groups out of Europe, you know, were constantly sending money, etc., resources, people to come and train people, paramilitary guys. And one specific guy's name was, and this was how I lead into how I got chased out of the country and why we, DLWP and I, had to leave the country, was because this cache of arms, that Russian sponsored arms that we had found, Major Miller had now earmarked to be delivered to WAMP, World Apartheid Movement, and they were on a remote farm near Zierist in a citrus valley. And what we were tasked to do was to take these weapons up to them. I went to my ANC handlers and told them they knew about it. You know, it was their original cache of weapons. But what we did is we sabotaged them as many of them as we could. We obviously had to keep live good ones around which we marked, and we'd use those to hand around and hand about when they wanted to check them, etc. We just played dumb when some of them didn't work, but we managed to, through a guy called, this guy still exists, he still lives here somewhere in South Africa, a guy called Conway, and another guy called Hans. These guys were doing paramilitary training for these right-wing white supremacist groups. And I, through my network of security, etc., knew these guys. I used to go shoot with them on the range up the west coast here. We'd go shoot weekly. So these guys knew me, trusted me. And so it was quite a natural segue into infiltrating this group. And ultimately what happened was, you know, there was a poisoning plot where they tried to poison the water. We managed to sabotage that plot, which was a poisoning of people in a township called Hammanskraal outside Victoria. And later on, we discovered that there was this beautiful wooden desk that was being built, but there were these secret compartments that were being drilled out and carved out. But whenever I wanted to take a closer look, the door always got closed in place. But I managed to get underneath the house and look through the floorboards and see them putting rifle parts into this desk, and it was a hidden compartment. Nelson Mandela was going to be inaugurated pretty soon, and I passed this intelligence over to Andre Lincoln. Andre Lincoln, who was my handler, deemed this, and who was the head of Nelson Mandela's unit. He was Nelson Mandela's spy. And ultimately, that's one of the reasons why I even decided to write this book.
Yeah.
Talk about this type of stuff because, you know, guys like us, we don't generally talk about this stuff, but I needed to talk about Lincoln's story and Gary's story because ultimately, you know, they've been betrayed.
Yes.
Their service to this country and them exposing corruption still to this day.
Jacob Zuma.
All over the headlines of the newspapers, if you Google their names in South Africa, fighting corruption. But this all goes back to that file that, you know, we handed over. But getting back to the operation, I gave Andre that actionable intelligence. And ultimately, it led to them finding that desk in the office of a security police man's office that was going to shoot Nelson Mandela and assassinate Nelson Mandela at his inauguration. But thankfully, Andre Lincoln and our team managed to stop that.
Excellent. Thank you, Bradley.
But, you know, I just realized I didn't finish answering your question. What ended up happening was Major Miller found out that Neil De Beer and I were the squeaky wheel, and they came up with this crazy plan to get rid of us by using, like I said, the Cape Flats is this really rough place that has gangsters, etc. They ended up using this gang organization that they used also for political killings and also for assassinations so that they could distance themselves from these things. But they used this group called the Young Americans to do a drive-by and try and kill myself and Neil De Beer. In a similar way to years later, they killed Cyril like that, see? The exact same way they killed Cyril. They assassinated him several years ago. We had to leave the country, which is sad because the democratic change was happening in South Africa. Jumping back to the inauguration, I don't know if you remember, they had that thick glass around Nelson Mandela.
Yes.
And the whole world's, all the world's leaders came. Imagine that round hit Mandela. That would have, you know, put this country into a mess in front of the world leaders. I'm just thankful that and grateful that Andre Lincoln was there. Yeah, so we ended up having to leave the country. And you know, it was, like I say, it was bittersweet because as we were leaving, the guys that were in exile were coming back to South Africa after, you know, being estranged from their country, from their people, from their culture, from everything, so many years. But it was too dangerous for us to live here.
That's remarkable, Bradley. Thank you. I just have one question left, sir. I know we've overrun our time. I really appreciate your generosity there. What was it that prompted you to write the book, Undercover with Mandela's Spies?
The story of the boy who crossed the square is the main reason. I wasn't going to write a book about spies because, you know, we don't do that. We don't talk about our tradecraft. But as I was writing this story of the boy who crossed the square and about this experience that I had and trying to understand how racism is weaponized by a political group that feel they are superior to others and where our world is today sort of prompted me. And like I've said, you know, and then I saw all the incredible work that Andre Lincoln and Jeremy Vieri were doing and exposing corruption. They exposed the use of clandestine equipment at a conference that the ANC was using to elect who was going to be the next president. They were using a grabber, Stingray, maybe a lot of your listeners might know, which is a false tower that picks up messaging, et cetera, from your cell phone, computer, emails, et cetera. And they exposed the fact that the National Commission of Police did a political favor. And yeah, so there were a lot of things like that, red flags. And I was like, you know, let me try and do something like that. And I found this mentor. If you ever want to write a book, guys, not sure how to do it, don't give up. And I was lucky enough to find a mentor in Mark Fine, who is a fellow South African. And I told him the story. I came to him with files, old intelligence reports that I kept, notes that I'd made. And we decided to, you know, also tell this story and unpack this little part of history.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we feel very relevant and what's going on today.
Excellent. Yeah. A major part of history that where I think a lot of it isn't full as understood as we might wish for it to be. Bradley Stain, this was a real pleasure, man. Thank you so much for taking time for me. It meant a lot.
Oh, no, my pleasure. My absolute pleasure. And thanks for what you do and unpacking history. I've listened to a few of your episodes. You've had some fascinating guests on there. You know, the only thing I'd sort of like to say is that I hope that your listeners, you know, will, you know, trust their guts and listen to their own intuitions and make smart decisions in what we face globally in society, and that is the rise of white power groups, the rise of hate groups, and, you know, so that we can address things like systemic racism within law enforcement culture, and so that we can also address police brutality. You know, for me, it's a very important cause that we try and figure out how we as individuals can do better in helping our fellow Black citizens to live peacefully and without fear.
Well said, Bradley. I think that might be the best note to end on, my friend. Ken, Bradley.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, absolutely. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.